loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, we're going to start with the issue of guns in America and the growing movement, especially among young people, to do something about it. Pro-gun control protests began in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, after the mass shooting there have begun to spread to other parts of the country, and politicians are beginning to notice. There will be a national march in Washington organized by students, high school students, on March 24th. Florida Senator Marco Rubio found himself scrambling to respond to voters who say he has been consistently in the pocket of the National Rifle Association. Even President Trump conceded yesterday that he would support several gun control measures, albeit very, very minor ones. We're joined from Atlanta, Georgia, by Anoa Changa. She is the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army and the host of the show The Way with Anoa. And we're joined from New York by Ted Rawl. He is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Anoa and Ted, thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
Anoa, you're in the South. You're not in Florida, but you're in Georgia. We see what's going on where, for a long time, I consider the issue of gun control or gun rights to have been really a battle between different, quote, nonprofit organizations. And weirdly, the National Rifle Association is a nonprofit, even though it's all about profits. But now we see something different happening. After the Parkland High School shooting, a lot of young people are directly getting involved, and they're very angry, and they're putting the politicians on the spot, and they're making the point over and over again that the reason nothing gets done about gun violence, or at least partly one of the reasons that it doesn't get done, is that a lot of politicians are actually in the pocket of the National Rifle Association and those corporations that are making tons of money over the mass proliferation of gun sales in America. When you see it down there where you are, Anoa, what's your reaction?
I mean, I think that we've seen this type of conversation happening, you know, across the most recent election cycle, right, about the influence of special interests and the real effect post Citizens United of spending in terms of donations to candidates, as well as spending in elections and things of that nature. So when we're having this conversation now, and we've seen so many of the kids make this point too, about elected officials being in the pockets of the gun lobby, specifically the NRA. And so these conversations are not, you know, separate, you know, entities. It's all interrelated and intertwined. So, I mean, even here in Georgia, we've seen pressure being put on our state, our senators from Georgia, Isaacson and my mind is in Purdue. You know, we've seen pressure starting to be put on them, like, oh my God, they're receiving money from the NRA. You know, how can you represent us when we're taking money from these groups? And someone made a point earlier, I think it was on Twitter, that the NRA claims that they're about, you know, protecting the rights of gun owners. And it's like, no, you're actually a lobby for like gun sellers and manufacturers and all people who make money in this process. You're not really about the protection of rights. So that's a fallacy. So it's really interesting, not being from the South, but now being down here where gun ownership and gun rights is something that is considered, you know, a very strong, and it's not just in the South, but I've noticed it more since I've lived here. It's something that's just like this really quintessential American thing, and that people trying to intrude upon it are somehow anti-American. And then we get faced with these instances, right? And what's so glaring, I think, right now about what happened in Parkland is we have, I know they're not babies, but I'm still going to call them the babies. We have babies very, very boldly and very, very confidently saying, like, you're not protecting us. This is insane. You need to be doing better. And they're leading the way. And I hope we finally see a quote unquote wake up call, but I'm not very, you know, confident that this is going to change anything either. I think these kids and the rest of us are in for a very long and deep haul on, as we are with so many other issues. I mean, really, we're looking at something that requires a cultural shift, not just here, but all across the country.
You know, Ted Rawl, this is a complicated question about why the United States has so many people dying or being wounded by gun violence? It's a complicated question. And even if there were massive gun control, you know, edicts that were passed all over the place, I don't think the issue of gun violence would disappear by any stretch of the imagination. And we want to be able to sort of break some of that down. But like there's people who die from suicides, and that's where most of the gun deaths come from. Then there are people who are killed in robberies. A lot of gun violence is men killing women, frequently their wives or spouses or girlfriends. There's the massive amounts of violence taking the lives of young Black people and young Latino people in urban environments. There's different categories where gun violence is manifesting itself in a very, well, deadly way. But what I want to focus on, what John and I want to focus on in the beginning, is the issue of the gun lobby. Because the gun lobby always talks about the Second Amendment. But what they're in it for is money. And the students and the young people who are up in arms and organizing right now, and I think this is important, they're making the point that this is really a byproduct of our current so-called free market system, where some people are making lots of money off of the sale of weapons. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the lobby of the guns is the gun lobby is incredibly powerful. One of the things that many Americans are unaware of is just what an incredibly huge economic sector American arms manufacturing is. The United States is by far the world's leading manufacturer. The last time I looked at the statistic, it exceeds the sum total of numbers 2 through 9 or 10 of other nations that produce weapons, and it's you know, we have the world awash in AK-47 knockoffs, RPGs, pistols. The United States just makes a lot of guns, and we like to sell them to other countries. We like to sell them to foreign police departments, armies, and we like to sell them to ourselves. And so it's big money. Everything in a capitalist system comes down to money, and this is just one of those things.
You know, I think part of the problem, too, is we have a president who's unhinged. I'm sorry to say that, but I'm just going to come out and say it. And there are two things that have pushed me over the edge on this issue today. One is a tweet that Donald Trump made at 9:31 this morning, and I'm going to read it. It says, "What many people don't understand or don't want to understand is that Wayne, Chris," that's Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA, "Chris and the folks who work so hard at the NRA are great people and great American patriots. They love our country and will do the right thing." And then in all capital letters, he writes, "Make America great again," with an exclamation point. Then, a little bit later this morning, at a roundtable discussion on school violence, he said this, and this is what really did push me over the edge on this issue. So this is a quote, and it says, he's talking about General Kelly, his chief of staff, and he says, "If he was a teacher, I wouldn't mind having him have a gun, because I guarantee you, he can use it better than anybody. There's not a security guard that you're going to hire that's going to handle a gun better than him. So if he's a teacher and other friends of his from the Marines are teaching, or other people like them, you want them to have a gun. But almost more importantly, nobody is going to attack that school because they know General Kelly's the history teacher. He's teaching about how we win wars, okay? And he's got a concealed weapon, but they're not going to know he's got a concealed weapon because we tell them that the bullets are going to be flying in the other direction."
Why do you think that's unhinged?
It doesn't even make sense grammatically, first of all. Secondly, we're talking about the lives of children here. We're talking about trying to protect our children. You know, I'm a former gun owner. I was never a member of the NRA, of course, but I owned a gun for many years. So it's not like I'm some kind of anti-gun, you know, lunatic or activist or whatever. I consider myself to be, on this issue, a normal average American. But comments like this are dangerous, and they don't advance the debate at all. I'm frankly embarrassed by this comment.
Noah, yeah, let's get your take. I think John's right about Trump, at least. I mean, this is a big discussion with many different aspects, but Trump is a true embarrassment.
I agree about the president being, and it's still so weird now talking to you guys over a year about this stuff, right? to call him the president.
Right.
But I do absolutely agree that this type of what I think is really most problematic about his conversation is the fact that he and then others who speak on his behalf or, you know, at his behest, they echo such really ridiculous and nonsensical sentiments that other people are like, well, yeah, that's a good idea. Like, no, like that's the type of stuff we expect from crazy people who rant on the internet. Oh, wait, he is a crazy person who rants on the internet who happens to be in the White House. But what's really disconcerting about the idea about guns in schools, right? Because we're saying that the answer to violence is more potential violence against a youth population that really needs a lot more help than what we're putting forth on the table right now, right? Like, we're talking about having teachers having guns in school, regardless of what the rationale is. And not to mention the fact that if you're talking about people who formerly served in the military, particularly if we're talking about, you know, younger veterans who may have been in Afghanistan and Iraq, however many tours, and all the issues we've seen with PTSD. And I mean, like, I'm just sitting here thinking about that analogy, thinking like this is just as problematic as saying that we need more veterans to go into police departments and give them guns to go patrol urban neighborhoods.
Yeah,
like,
what could possibly go wrong?
Right. And I look at my 14-year-old. My 14-year-old is 6 feet tall, right? And I look at my 14-year-old and I'm just like, my kid is probably the one that is going to more likely get shot if a teacher has a gun in school than whatever kid may accidentally come or may bring a gun in school. Like we just really need to be real about the state of America right now when it comes to you know, shootings and things of that nature. Like, yes, this type of stuff is random. We do need to figure out how to resolve it, but let's not make it even worse. You know, on the other end, and I don't even see like people. I've seen people say, "Oh, let's give him a benefit of the doubt," or "Let's hear." I'm just like, I don't even understand how you can even say that, like, ever out of anything he's ever said. This is something we don't need to give him the benefit of the doubt. Like, what we need to do is continue to work on the organizing work that we've been doing to replace people, not just in our Congress and our state legislators, to really get educating, start educating people about what these issues are. But also look at, it's not just a matter of we regulating gun. Yes, we need to regulate gun sales and magazine clips and the whole host of reforms people have been proposing. Yes, that's something needs to happen. But we also need to really start looking at the cultural issue that is existing here, right? There is a specific reason, and it's not just, we can't just blame it on mental illness, how people are mentally ill, because there are a lot of people there. I have teenagers, so mine talk about this often. There are a lot of kids who have issues with depression and anxiety. There's a lot of issues with bullying and stuff like that. I don't know what the statistics are, so I'm not going to make a statistical statement, but I know we have a lot of issues with kids contemplating suicide. There's so much that's going on. Most kids who are running around depressed or anxious are not turning around and killing all their classmates. You know what I'm saying? So that's something that we need to stop doing. We need to stop scapegoating this. This is just simply mental illness, and it'll go away if we just figure that part. There's something deeper culturally that is a problem, and the lack of value of life that unfortunately there are children who are learning that. And that's something that we need to figure out how to deal with as well. Like, it's not going to just because we get some legislation on the books doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to get resolved. The last thing I'll say about this is I'm really concerned about middle-class white America talking about gun control and gun violence in a way that ignores that when we start talking about enforcement and reform, that often leads to increased militarization in Black and brown communities. And as we have this increased presence in terrorism in the form of ICE on brown communities in particular, we can't disregard these other political facets that go in hand when we start talking about enforcing actual gun crime and gun laws and stuff like that. So I have multiple concerns. And the president's nonsense, I'm just like, why are we even talking about him?
Yeah, understood. We'd prefer not to.
I know we have to. It's newsworthy, but yeah.
But you're right. I mean, let's look at some of the other statistics. African-American men are 13 times more likely than non-Hispanic white men to be shot and killed with guns. African-Americans, the African-American population makes up 14% of the U.S. population, but are victims of more than half of all gun homicides. And already, as Anoa's pointing out, in cities, in urban areas, and particularly in Black communities, there has been severe gun control. I mean, really, a lot of people have gone to jail for the possession of a firearm that would be completely legal somewhere else. And of course, where there is violence, people tend to find, and they don't believe the police are going to stop crime or protect them. So people try to get a gun because they want to protect themselves or their families. That's completely understandable. And so more illegality, more imposition of repressive laws will be, I think, given the nature of the America's criminal justice system, certainly be carried out with a vengeance against Black and Latino communities and against poor working class communities that are predominantly Black and Latino. Ted, I want to shift the discussion, if we can, to take up what the students are actually doing right now and the politicians who are standing in their way. Because, again, we've talked about this issue a lot, of course, in the last 2 weeks since the Parkland shooting. We've discussed it in the past. It's a national thing that so many people are killed by guns, and there are so many guns in America. There's more guns than there are people in the United States, and there are 5 million AR-15 owners in the United States. But I want to play an audio clip from a town hall meeting that included Marco Rubio. It wasn't Marco Rubio's best night by any stretch, but I want to play a few of these audio clips and have you, Ted, and Danoa Chenga react to them. Let's hear the first one.
First of all, the answer is people buy into my agenda.
You can say
number
no.
Second, well, I
guys,
the influence
quiet,
of any group.
On, we're going to be here all night.
The influence of these groups comes not from money. The influence comes from the millions of people that agree with the agenda. So the millions of Americans that support the NRA and who
all
support
right.
gun rights
sorry,
groups.
Senator. Guys,
if you
Cameron is
yes,
having
no.
a conversation with Senator Rubio, let them talk.
Marco Rubio was being, you know, booed there by the audience when Cameron Caskey, a survivor of the shooting at Parkland, asked him whether he would stop taking any more NRA donations. And Rubio responded about his defense of the Second Amendment. He's received $3 million from the NRA.
So what's hilarious about what Senator Rubio has to say is that, you know, it's not about the people. It's about not about the number of people who support gun rights. It is about the money that this lobbying organization can put together. Look, millions of people like the Rolling Stones and the Grateful Dead, but they don't have a lobbying group that can go to Washington and buy senators like Rubio. It is about the money. It is not just about the membership dues that these people pay. It is also about the massive infrastructure of the American weapons production industry that has created this odd and encouraged this odd culture where people feel like they want to possess weapons that really don't have much application for hunting or for self-defense. I mean, I go to gun ranges. I'm like John. I'm not a anti-gun zealot. I've watched people fire AR-15s at these things. You know, these are big shells. They're like little missiles. They're maybe half an inch wide, several inches long. There's just an incredible amount of power. And the only reason you would want to have one, really, is because they're fun to shoot. And there's no denying that. But you have to weigh societal goods versus societal evils when you consider whether you want to allow something. I mean, people got pleasure from smoking, but cities and other municipalities decided to act against smoking because so many people were dying of cancer and other illnesses as a result of it. It created more harm than good. I think at a certain point, a society has to say, look, here's this amendment that was passed in 1789 that probably isn't really very relevant to a highly urbanized and suburbanized society that has replaced a highly rural society where people are not even hunting for food anymore. If they hunt, it's only for fun. So, people are dying so that other people can have fun. Is that really worth it?
Yeah, Noah, go ahead, your reaction. Those students are really fired up.
Yeah.
They're really giving it to Rubio.
And I don't think Rubio's ever gone through a town hall meeting like that, ever, since he became a politician.
No, I don't think so. And I like the last part of what was just said. You know, there are people dying so that other people can have fun. Is it really worth it? And I think that's a really good framing because everyone gets caught up in this notion about rights and protecting our guns and its fundamental right. And really what we're talking about is, you know, we're talking about the people who are really lobbying to protect the right to sell massive amounts of weaponry and make a lot of money, and people who are doing this socially, right, for personal fun. And again, I'm like you, John, like, you know, having gotten older, having lived in West Virginia, now down here, you know, I understand about recreational shooting and things like that. But at the same time, you know, acting as if there's this absolute right to have,
right,
you know, access to these types of weapons is insane and ridiculous.
It is.
I have one of my friends from law school, she was going through, she's like, when we talk about, you know, absolute rights and things like that, and looking at the intent of the framers, this isn't even what they were talking about. Right. You know, so just thinking about his response, like, you know, it's the millions of people who agree with my agenda. That's BS. Let's just be real. Millions of people. I don't even know that he can clearly enunciate what his agenda actually is. Right. It's very clear that his agenda is the agenda that is given to him, whether it's the Koch brothers, whether it's the NRA, whatever special interest is dictating specifically to what needs to be done. We know for a fact that there are lobbyist groups, whether it's one of the different subsidiaries under the Koch brothers or it's the NRA or whatever group, we know that there's legislation that is given to congressmen, that is given to, you know, state legislators. We know that this happens and that there are literally groups that are handing out rubber stamps, you know, boilerplate types of legislation and laws, to bills to be implemented that has one agenda, and it is not about protecting people and their rights. You know, it is about making money, and it's about protecting certain industries and special interests. And so listening to Marco Rubio, it's really fascinating, you know, thinking about how disingenuous they are when they speak. And it's like I almost want to believe you believe what you're saying, dude, but I am sure you don't. You're just trying to keep your job. And this is my challenge when we have progressives, we have people who are talking about running campaigns and elections. You really need to figure out how to do this smarter, because we're not going to have the same money as the other side. We're not going to have the same access to resources, but you are going to have people. You are going to have the right side of the issues. And so you got to figure out a better way to run your campaigns and get your people out there so we can remove people like Marco Rubio from office. Because that's what I listen. When I hear this stuff, I just hear the challenge of, we need to get that person out of office. And again, that's only the first step. There's so much more work that needs to be done besides removing people from office. But at the same time, it's something that needs to be done. And we need to figure out how to tip the scales a different way.
I want to play, we only have 4.5 minutes left. I want to play another audio clip, Ted Raw. This is Fred Gutenberg, whose daughter was shot and killed in the mass shooting, pressuring Rubio to acknowledge that guns are a problem. And he's obviously has a lot of support from the audience, nearly drowning out Rubio. But let's listen to this clip and then again get your reaction.
Senator Rubio, my daughter, running down the hallway at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, was shot in the back.
Yes, sir.
With an assault weapon. The weapon of choice.
Yes, sir.
Okay? It is too easy to get. It is a weapon of war. The fact that you can't stand with everybody in this building and say that, I'm sorry.
Sir, I do believe what you're saying is true.
So, really important point, Ted. And again, these are the voices of the victims and the voices of the survivors of this attack. Again, making the point that that it's all about money. Here, the shooter... is obviously not only deeply mentally ill with serious anger management, it's not just mental illness, as Anoa pointed out. He's obviously has a predisposition to violence. The police have been called to his house over and over again. He has obvious problems, and yet he still has, as an 18-year-old, the right to buy an AR-15. He doesn't have the right to health care. He doesn't have the right to mental health care, but he absolutely has the right to buy this automatic weapon, because that's what the gun lobby wants him to have. And that's what rights are about in the country right now. But respond again, if you would, to the voice of Fred Gutenberg, his daughter shot in the back as she ran down the hall.
Having been to war, he's right. It is a weapon of war. And it doesn't belong in civilian hands. It just does not. You know, the thing is, though, in terms of the mental health thing, I think that it's important to realize that I'm a little worried about the idea that the government is going to decide what constitutes mental illness. In many states, like New York, for example, that have prohibitions against people who are supposedly mentally ill against buying guns. These are very broad statutes. If you've ever been involuntarily committed to an institution, even for 1 minute, you're not qualified to buy a weapon. And for example, you know, in New York, if you, let's say you're in a you're in a traumatic incident, you're in a car accident, someone that you love dies next to you, they'll take you to a mental institution for observation for a few hours before releasing you. That means technically under the law, you are no longer for the rest of your life allowed to buy a firearm in New York State. There's also some laws that constitute anything that's defined in the DSM issued by the American Psychological Association. Any condition would make you unqualified to buy a firearm. So for example, until 1989, when homosexuality was classified as a mental disorder, gay and lesbian people would not be permitted to buy a gun to defend themselves, I guess, presumably from homophobes. And now transgender people are still in the DSM-5 as being listed as suffering a mental disorder. So I get very nervous whenever I think that the government's going to decide who's mentally ill. You know, there's talk now of, for example, involuntarily detaining people who are considered to be a danger to themselves or others for up to 3 days, which seems like a terrible violation of habeas corpus rights. So I think we have to look at a lot of different things. It's a complicated issue, but, you know, it's true what you said. That kid did not have, he had the right to buy a gun. He didn't have the right to a college education. He didn't have the right to transportation to a job if he couldn't afford a car, couldn't afford health, not a right to health care, but he has that right to buy a gun. This is a society with some seriously misplaced priorities.
We're going to have to leave it there. And it's such a big subject, such a complicated subject. We'll come back to it. And we didn't even get, Noah, I wanted to get your input too. 50 women are shot to death every month by their spouses, by their boyfriends. In other words, the rampant violence against women, gun violence is one dramatic part of it. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from Atlanta, Georgia by Anoa Changa. She's the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army and the host of the show, The Way with Anoa. And we're joined from New York City by Ted Rawl. He is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You're listening to Loud and Clear after a short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul's also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. That's PLN. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you.
Paul, you and I were talking offline about the latest issue of Prison Legal News. It is just chock full of important articles this time. I mean, it's always full of important articles, but this time it just seemed to be just jammed. I mean, there was so much in there that I think our listeners would like to hear, and so many that are important to sort of the day-to-day processes by which prisoners or those accused of crimes work their way through the courts. Why don't you tell us some of the more important issues that you're working on right now?
Well, some of the stuff that we're working on is we're working on the financial exploitation of prisoners. We've identified that as being you know, as being a really important issue because it's also something that's happened, like it's come out of whole cloth and it's being pushed by basically a handful of private hedge fund-owned corporations. And I think that a lot of people have the mistaken idea that criminal justice reform, that A, reform when it happens is good, and B, that it only happens because of legislative action or things like that. But the reality is that, you know, probably for the last 30 years, all the reform that's happened in the criminal justice system has been pretty negative and pretty bad, certainly at least as far as prisoners and their families go, and I think overall society as a whole. But also, more importantly, though, a lot of the reform that's happened has been at the instigation of you know, private players, and with regard to the financial exploitation of prisoners, this handful of companies has basically come out of out of nowhere, out of whole cloth, have just come up with new means to exploit prisoners and their families financially in ways that didn't even exist, say, 15 or 20 years ago. And this has to do with everything from prison telephone calls, the fact of why, you know, prisoners and their families pay the highest amount for prison phone call of anyone in America. And, you know, hundreds of dollars a month in prison phone bills. We're seeing in-person visitation being eliminated in prison and jails across the country and being replaced by video calling, where people are being charged up to $1, $2 a minute to see their loved ones in prison. Mail is being eliminated. Mail delivery and mail services being eliminated so that these companies can charge prisoners and their families 50 cents or $1 a message for emails. It's just really kind of like an exponentially expanding area of financial exploitation where prisoners and their families are just monetized by these corporations with their government collaborators. So that's one of our priorities. The other one, of course, remains our longstanding commitment to free speech and ensuring the delivery of books and magazines to prisoners. We recently launched a public records project where we're looking for more, basically increasing our investigative reporting into prisons and jails and expanding it into police departments as well in terms of how, how the police state impacts our lives and the human and civil rights abuses that they commit on a daily basis. So, you know, and of course, then we've got our daily news cycle of reporting just what's going on in the news and everything else. So we have a lot going on.
Kevin Gustala, you're in Chicago. You're a writer for Shadowproof.com and a co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. When Paul is explaining, even in sort of short strokes about the financial exploitation of prisoners, I would have to say, one, I think most people don't have a clue about that.
Agreed.
I mean, that's such a big issue. And of course, prisoners are not generating any substantial income, even from work they do. That's a huge issue. Talk about how Shadowproof sees it.
I would say that most people probably are ignorant of the fact that there are economic pressures involved. In other words, they see people who are incarcerated as just criminals. They define them by the crimes that they were convicted of committing, or if they're in some kind of pretrial confinement, they're defined by the crimes they're accused. And they don't think about the pressures that they have, the debt that they might have, the sort of poverty that might be in play. And not to stray too far from what Paul was talking about, or not to jump the gun here, but you know, there was a major report just put out by the American Civil Liberties Union about how these debtors are being pressured and attacked by the sort of firms, the hedge funds that you're talking about, the law firms that are involved in making money after pursuing people in debt to coerce them. And even people who aren't committing crimes are being jailed just because they don't have money. And I think this is a product of the dual economy that we have in the United States, where you have, you know, some people would be ignorant because they're doing well. They're in the part of the economy that's flourishing and seeing good wages, and they have good paying jobs. But then on the other hand, you have people who are stuck in the other economy where they're stuck in low wages and they're depressed, or they're at the risk of being laid off because those parts, those industries are actually struggling. And so I don't think people might put this together, connect the issues of incarcerated people with the economic poverty issues that are ongoing in the United States.
Paul, back to you. You published an article in the latest issue of Prison Legal News magazine talking about the treatment of people who are mentally ill in prisons, and how the mentally ill, I'm thinking specifically of the U.S. penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania,
right?
How those who are mentally ill are put in USP Lewisburg for the purpose of rehabilitation. They're supposed to go through counseling and therapy. They're supposed to be medicated. And this is a process that's supposed to take a year. But in fact, there is no therapy. There is no counseling. There is no medication. They're not treated for their mental illness in any way. And so they're forced to then go back through the whole process again. And I'll add that USP Lewisburg is notorious because it is a maximum security prison, and it's also a federal transportation hub. So regardless of what security level you happen to find yourself in, whether it's maximum, medium, low, or minimum, you could end up in maximum at Lewisburg. Talk about mental health care in prison, or the lack of mental health care in prison.
Well, I think for the most part, the lack of mental health care in prison is kind of like the biggest issue. And I have to say is that, you know, we've got an ongoing coverage of this issue literally since we started. For 28 years, we've been covering lack of a better term, just the crisis in mental health care. And one of the things that's happened is that we've seen pretty much as beds in psychiatric facilities declined starting in like the late 70s and accelerating in the 1980s to the present, we've seen that rise of more mentally ill prisoners in prison, in the criminal justice system. This is coupled with the criminalization of poverty and mental illness. You know, you talk to a lot of sheriffs in different parts of the country, and they'll tell you that their jail is de facto the largest mental health treatment facility in their state. And I think that this is also kind of the thing of, you know, treating people that are mentally ill is expensive. You need psychiatrists, you need people that have been trained and know how to deal with and treat the mentally ill. And basically, as a society, we seem to have taken the economic and political view of we're not going to worry about the mentally ill in terms of providing them with adequate treatment. Instead, we're going to criminalize them, send them to prison, where they're just basically going to be warehoused, and their mental health issues and their mental illness is not going to be treated. And under the best case scenario, they won't be physically abused, and they won't be physically abused too much. They're just going to be warehoused without adequate treatment. And when we look at like the statistics, the very, very conservative statistics are that 40% of the American prison population is mentally ill, and this is by seriously mentally ill. And the reason I say it's a conservative estimate is it comes down to how is mental illness being defined. And I think for your listeners, when they think about mental illness, we're talking about people that have serious Axis 1 and Axis 2 mental disorders. This isn't just someone that, hey, they've got a little quirk, they just have some quirks, or they have
depression or something like that. These are people who are truly, seriously mentally ill.
Exactly. And these are people, and in some cases, these are people that are of serious, they pose a serious risk both to themselves in terms of self-harming and also to others in terms of potential physical risk. And in a lot of cases, you know, they're not able to function on their own. So instead, our social response has been basically caging them. And this is also one of those things, too. I think that we know that with mentally ill people with appropriate treatment, most mentally ill people respond positively. You know, they can be given medications, they can be given therapy, they can be given appropriate responses that enable them to function in society. And the reality is that in prisons and jails, they're not getting any of that. In fact, one of the things that happens is all too often, mentally ill prisoners are not able to function very well in prison, where there's litanies of rules. It's a brutal surveillance, surveilled reality. And so they wind up being put into isolation. And that's what the article that we're running about this lawsuit at Lewisburg basically is about, is that basically mentally ill prisoners, not only are they not getting adequate mental health treatment, but as a result of their mental illness, they're being placed in solitary confinement, which we know from 200 years of study and research that solitary confinement tends to exacerbate mental illness and make it a lot worse. Not just worse, but a lot worse.
It sure does. And then you end up with a situation like what we're seeing in Texas, for example. I'm looking at an article that's entitled "Suicide Attempts Have More Than Doubled in Texas Prisons." And it says here, the numbers show a sizable increase in attempts starting 5 years ago. In 2013, Texas prisons averaged 65 suicide attempts per month. By 2015, that number had risen to 97. But over the same period, the prison population has decreased. So from 2007 to 2013, we're talking about 40 or so suicide attempts per 10,000 inmates. By now, it's 100 suicide attempts per 10,000 inmates. Kevin, go ahead.
There's two things that can be said. Another story connected to that is gaining some attention over the past week involved a lawsuit that was filed against a Louisiana prison because they're apparently chaining these prisoners to wooden chairs and they're forcing them into extreme cold conditions. And, you know, John, I would use a term that you're probably all too familiar with here. It seems like they're trying to force compliance on these prisoners and maybe even create like learned helplessness for these prisoners instead of actually giving them treatment that they need, trying to turn them into pieces of furniture instead of actually treating them like human beings. But there's also a racial component to this as well that I think we should raise very briefly here. And just to mention something specific, my colleague Brian Sonnenstein covered this report back in 2015 on black women who were incarcerated in L.A., county jails, and just the sort of impact that they had. And, you know, by the way, they made up about a third of the jail population in LA when they're only about, they only make up 9.9% of all women in Los Angeles County. So disproportionately, they're already incarcerated, but, you know, they're mistreated, they're abused, and devalued. One inmate described being placed on 24-hour lockdown, denied access to the day room for weeks at a time because guards said she and other black inmates were too ghetto. And again, this sort of like racism already feeds into everything, and it goes across the board regardless of gender. But then when you have that, when you need treatment for mental illness, you get denied it because you're already dehumanized.
I can tell you when I was in prison at FCI Loretto in central Pennsylvania, we had several inmates who attempted suicide. One of them had a long history of mental illness. And what they do with prisoners who attempt suicide is instead of giving them some kind of intervening assistance, therapy, whatever, anything, counseling, what they do is they strip them naked. They put them in the medical unit. They chain them to a bed. One of the walls is just a giant window. It's a wall of glass. And then they hire other prisoners to just sit in a chair in 8-hour shifts and stare at this chained nude inmate to make sure that he somehow doesn't unchain himself and try to commit suicide again. Paul, are there any programs out there that better address the issue of mentally ill prisoners or of suicide attempts? Is there any state that's sort of leading the way in new policies?
Sadly, no. It just seems to be more of a race to the bottom, if you want to call that leading. I think that part of the problem is just that, you know, overall, medical care in general and mental health care in particular is expensive. It was one of the things, just to put this into context, was a couple of years ago I was at a conference in California about the litigation surrounding the inadequate medical care in California. And one of the things that they had done as part of the, in fact, the whole California prison system's medical system is in federal receivership. It was that bad. And one of the first things that the federal receiver did was he lifted the salary caps on state employees employed by the medical system of the prisons, because he found that the low salaries were impacting their ability to hire qualified staff. And so one of the things they did is, so they raised the salaries, and I was, frankly, I have to say, I was stunned when I heard that the salary for a prison psychiatrist in California is over $300,000. That's base pay. And that even paying psychiatrists $300,000 a year, they were unable to fill the positions because they built so many of these prisons in very remote locations, like Susanville, in Bakersfield and places like that, where frankly they couldn't find qualified professionals that even for $300,000 a year were willing to work for the prison system. And of course, you know, most prisons pay substantially less. But it's a combination of factors of, you know, low salaries, coupled with, you know, pretty bad working conditions. And I think we should just be clear, too, that, you know, most people that work in prisons aren't terribly enthused about working there either. It's not right. A great work environment.
Yeah, they take those jobs because they can't get any other jobs. I can tell you that the physician that we had in my prison was a disgraced former pediatrician from Cleveland who simply couldn't get any other job because of his disciplinary record. So you're not going to get the top people in prisons.
Exactly. And I think that's also one of the areas of concern that we've had at HRDC for a long time are prisons and jails that hire physicians and medical personnel that have these lengthy disciplinary histories of killing or raping or maiming their patients. And the other thing is they're also uninsurable too. It's a combination of their bad doctors and they can't get insurance and they have boundary right. issues. So these are kind of like, you know, it's compounding one problem on top of another. But even in a place like California, where as a result of multiple federal court orders and a federal receivership, they have to pay higher wages, even with the higher wages, they still can't attract and hire competent, qualified people for these positions. So, you know, that's some of the things that we think are... are part of the problem. And I'll note, too, that the federal government, between the Bureau of Prisons and the Veterans Administration, are some of the biggest employers of doctors who don't have medical licenses because they've lost them due to disciplinary behavior by state medical licensing boards.
Kevin, I wanted to ask you about an article that I saw on shadowproof.com, your website. It was about a New York... jail. Inspectors for this jail smuggled in contraband just as a test to see what they could get away with. And frankly, they got away with everything. They were able to get weapons, razor blades, drugs, cell phones. Nobody stopped them. We saw the same thing recently. When I say recently, I mean in the last year at the Baltimore County Jail, which doubles as a federal holding facility. How much of a problem is this? You know, we joked last week when you were on the show that it's really the cops that are bringing in all the contraband. It's not prisoners smuggling it in or visitors smuggling it in or drones dropping it in, although that's certainly been attempted. It's usually the cops bringing it in. Go right ahead.
Well, I think this is a huge problem. And I believe that, you know, what I would add as we continue our discussion from last week is the extra details that people don't know about how much of an effect this has on visitors and how much of an effect this has on the inmates. We started to scratch the surface, but the fact is that, you know, everyone who is personnel for the prison gets a pass, gets to come in, gets to be treated. Think of it the same way in which you might be able to move a little bit more freely if you were working for a Homeland Security or something. You know, they just in general treat you like you're probably not going to violate the safety and security. That's how TSA has been able to steal from people on the belts and take people's property for the past years. So you think about it in this prison, these people who work, the guards are able to come in and out and bring whatever they want. Meanwhile, you have things that happen to people who are trying to go visit family who are incarcerated, and they are effectively dehumanized. They are not really allowed to have decency when they go. They're intimidated or harassed, and they're made to feel like they shouldn't be visiting the people who they have come to keep a connection. Because after all, if we're going to be freeing these people and they're going to go back to their life after they've served their time, they need to be able to maintain connections with family, or else when they're released, if they have tension, if they have conflicts with family members, they're just going to descend back into the same behavior they engaged in before, and we're going to have recidivism. So it seems like, you know, part of the problem here isn't just the corrupt culture in the prison that allows contraband to make it in, but it's also the fact that, you know, they don't recognize that they're going overboard against other people when it comes to contraband. And then what happens is, you know, you feel like there is a parallel justice system. There's a system for the visitors and the inmates, and then there's a system for the guards. And obviously, quite clearly, the one for the guards says that you can engage in whatever you want, and you're going to get off time and time again.
Paul, we've got about 4 minutes left, and I want to raise an issue that you have raised repeatedly in Prison Legal News. Kevin also has covered this at Shadowproof, and that is trans people in prison and the lack of any medical assistance, respect, the lack of any human compassion for trans people in prison. You've got an article in Prison Legal News, the most recent issue, about a trans woman who was denied her hormones and medication and ended up developing a life-threatening situation. Why don't you tell our listeners about that?
Sure. So basically, you know, I think one of the things too is just to be clear is when we're talking about the medical issues that face prisoners, that trans prisoners, prisoners with serious medical needs are also not getting, as a general rule, they're not getting the medical care that they need as well. And transgender prisoners face, I think, a combination of the medical neglect that all too often permeate the medical system overall. And I think it's coupled with a bit of homophobia and, you know, dislike, I think, for just for lack of a better term, for prisoners who are transgender, not gender, you know, within the norm of prison officials, you know, gender norm views. And so this is another case where a transgender prisoner was denied medical care and they filed suit. And that's the reality, too, is that all too often, anytime that trans prisoners need medical care, they need to literally file suit. This case involved the Lackawanna County Jail in Pennsylvania. The prisoner is a male to female transgender prisoner who had been taking hormones and living as a woman since 2005. And he gets to jail and for violating probation for using a stolen credit card, and basically tells them that he needs hormones and the jail refuses to provide them, and to no avail. And after that, he winds up having to file suit and filing a motion for what's called a temporary restraining order, where the court orders the defendants to provide the medical care. So basically, it took a court order, a lawsuit, and a court order to get the jail officials to provide the medical treatment, in this case hormones, that that the plaintiff had been receiving prior to going to prison. And I think that's also one of the realities too, is that all too often prisoners are faced with the prospect of not getting adequate medical care, whatever their issue is, whether it's gender dysphoria, which is what causes transsexualism, or that's the underlying disorder, to mental health, to just, you know, simple things like, you know, prisoners that are diabetic, that that have hypertension, things like that. When you look at the thousands of prisoners that die every year of medical neglect in American prisons, they're not dying of some exotic disease that has no known cure,
right,
or anything like that. They're dying of really simple things like untreated diabetes, untreated hypertension, AIDS that isn't being properly medicated. And for transgender prisoners, they kind of run into, I think, the double roadblock of having medical needs that prison officials refuse to address, and also, I think, coupled with, you know, I think just to be blunt about it, transphobia and homophobia, where the people running these prisons and jails, many of whom are evangelical Christians, are fundamentally hostile to the very nature of the prisoners they're guarding.
Let me jump in. We have about 45 seconds mentioning the evangelicals. Billy Graham has died, and it was the prisoners at Angola Prison who built his casket. And of course, Kevin, they make, as we started this show about financial exploitation, they make a few pennies per hour, I believe. Anyway, go ahead, Kevin. You get the last word. 30 seconds.
Well, I think it's quite a statement about what those people think about those prisoners. And I know for a fact that in Angola, there are evangelicals who would shove their religion at these prisoners instead of look after their well-being. And it's quite a statement that they were made through this slave kind of labor to build this casket for Billy Graham.
Doing God's work, I guess. I'm joking, of course. John Kiriakou, go ahead, take us out.
So we're out of time, but we're going to do this again next week. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. Paul is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and also editor of Prison Legal News magazine. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.